This is Ross Coulthart, and you are listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and I am joined on the podcast today by a former intelligence official with a PhD in applied mathematics. He's an engineer. He's served as faculty at various universities, including Virginia Tech, among many, many achievements on a glittering CV. I'd like to welcome to the podcast Dr. Robert Maguire, or as many of you may know him from socials, Science Bob. Bob, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, Andy, it's really good to be on with you. I'm a fan of yours.
Thank you, Bob. And listen, I genuinely, this isn't a lie or exaggeration. I was in work today and I was sorting out your bio and introduction. It was the longest part of the interview to fix, because looking through your CV, your LinkedIn, what you've done since a young age, it's very hard to pick just a few things. So I hope the introduction's, one, done you justice, but two, kind of sets you up.
It's more than enough, Andy. I'm here to chit chat about our mutual interest.
Well, let's
go look at that if they're interested.
Oh, no, of course. And listen, let's get into that then, Bob. You've had one hell of a life. I mean, from the get-go, from your very earliest formative years, do you want to share with the listeners and viewers a little bit about those kind of early years that were filled with some pretty incredible events?
Yes, Andy, I'm happy to, because I think it sets the right context for the rest of the conversation. So I was born in Middle Tennessee, in the southern part of the United States, in 1954. And shortly before my first birthday, my parents had made the decision to move to Alabama, but I got sick. I got cerebral encephalitis and had an extremely high temperature. And I was in neonatal intensive care, or whatever they called it back then, for a while. And the doctors were not hopeful. They told my parents that I would survive as a vegetable or I wouldn't survive. And probably the latter was preferable, but my parents would not allow them to move that along. They insisted on me being cared for. And I have, of course, no memory of it, but I had 3 cardiac arrests. The arrests lasted over a minute each. So people would now call those NDEs, but I have no memory of them. But shortly after that, when my parents were assured I was a goner and I had these arrests, the doctor came in and told my mother he was going to try one thing and he had no idea if it would work. He put ice water into my stomach and it lowered my temperature, and slowly but surely I recovered. And I moved to Alabama within a month, completely recovered. And of course they thought it was miraculous. I don't have any memories much, except an occasional bit here and there between age 1 and 3. But at 3 years old, I got up after a typical night's sleep and went in where my mother was visiting with her best friend, drinking coffee and gossiping. And I went over to the bookshelf and pulled out books and started reading them to them. And it was an overnight miraculous kind of thing where I learned to read, and my mother and father cannot explain how that happened. And then, so I went on and had kind of an interesting childhood. And at 10 years old, something really big happened. I suddenly was kind of this technical geek superstar at 10 years old. And at 8 years old, I was teaching science to all the other children in the playground. And my teacher kept calling my mother up there to get her to come and look at it. But at 10 years old, I got my amateur radio license. I built my own telescope, built my own rockets, worked with my nearly 18-year-old neighbor at 10 years old to build the largest fossil collection in Alabama, and I memorized Gray's Anatomy from cover to cover. So from that moment on, my family was certain that I was going to become a medical doctor, which would have been a very prestigious occupation at that time in the southern part of the U.S., So I went to school and to be in pre-med. And when my first semester, I picked up my girlfriend who was from my hometown. We went to the same university to drive her home for the weekend. On the way, we had an hour and a half of missing time. And I didn't remember this until much later, which I'll go into, but I remembered it. And I called her and said, "Do you recall us going home and getting lost in the middle of nowhere and it taking, we didn't quite know?" She says, "Yeah, I think we were gone for over an hour and I don't remember anything." So within 2 weeks, I had changed everything in my life. I changed universities, I changed majors to the things that I do today. It was as if I was programmed to move on and do what I'm doing, because this has been the natural fit for my life ever since. And so I led a decades-long career in technology and applied mathematical sciences, and did a lot of work in chemistry and engineering and so forth. When I decided to retire, because I wanted to enhance my retirement, so I went to Virginia Tech, where faculty is allowed to form companies, and I formed multiple companies. The two really good ones were Hawkeye 360, which is a satellite observational platform that is now used by the government in its surveillance system in orbit. And I found a digital communications company that enhances cellular telephone communications, amongst other things, called Federated Wireless. And Andy, all of the ideas from those two companies and many other ideas I had long before then were downloads. I have no idea, because you can look at my training. I do not have formal training in either of those spaces. And so then I began hearing inside the government, and even shown some pieces of evidence that were being passed around all over government of UFOs. And so my curiosity won the day, and I started investigating, looking at YouTube, found Richard Dolan, saw that he was highly recommended by a lot of people from DOD and the intelligence community that I knew. So I got his books and read them. I began following him on YouTube. I joined his website, and then I became the administrator and moderator for the Richard Dolan Forum. And during that period, in 2019, he interviewed Christopher Bledsoe for four one-hour-ish episodes. And I just was run over by curiosity. So I reached out to Bledsoe and asked him, could I come visit? That I knew he had had other scientists and people from the government to visit. And I gave him a bit of my background. It took him several weeks to reply, but he responded positively. And I went over in January of 2020. And so we sat around and talked for 3 days while it was cloudy. And basically, he unloaded on me almost all of his secrets. And at the last night we were there, we went outside and observed, and we saw three of his gigantic 40-foot orbs, two of his gigantic 40-foot orbs right over the top of the trees. We saw flash bulbs in the trees that, when I wished inside my head, they would come out of the trees where I could see them. They went out of the trees where I could see them. Then I saw this purple hazy, glowing haze stuff right over the top of the trees, like the surface of a lake or a fog or whatever. And I just sat there in awe observing it, making sure that I could see it as it slowly got brighter. And as sure as I was soon in my own mind that it was actually real and was there, maybe it was a hallucination, but I perceived it was there, it disappeared almost instantly, just as I became convinced. And Chris, without blinking, said, "Okay, they're gone. We're done for the night. We can go inside." So that was really my first wow moment, that he was in telepathic communications with whatever this is. And then my life has not been the same since. Okay, after I left Chris Bledsoe and went home, Hitchhiker followed me home. And I began having odd things happen in my home, including the kind of final straw, which one day I was laying on the bed reading a book, and water squirted me. And I couldn't figure out where the water had come from. I thought maybe the ceiling was leaking, but I couldn't detect any place where water was coming through. And it happened again a couple of days later. And I asked the person who was in there with me, did they see it? And they said, "Yeah, there's water on your bedspread and your legs." And then a couple of days after that, I heard the person at the other end go, "Whoa," just as water hit me. And I got up and walked down there, and there was water on the floor in front of them. So both of us had been squirted by water that I'll call an apport out of the middle of the air. And I checked into things, and I had just had the roof redone on my house. I thought it might be leaking. It hadn't rained there in over 2 weeks. It'd been dry. So that just wasn't it. And I finally tumbled to it. This was some kind of weird apport phenomenon. So I called Chris and told him what had happened and had the things and asked him, had things like this happened before? And he said, yes. He says, common that hitchhikers go home with people who has visited here and been exposed to the phenomenon. So 2 weeks after that, the person who was with me had suffered a stroke about a year before and had right side weakness. Within 2 weeks, the right side weakness completely disappeared. So at the end of that year, COVID hit, school closed. I was not going to be able to see any students or peers, so I retired. And I had a detailed medical checkup from my cardiologist because I had had two heart attacks. And so the cardiologist went, "I'm going to put you on a treadmill with a dye so that we can check what's going on." He did that, and he says, "I don't know how to explain this, but you have zero evidence of damage from a heart attack." He says, "It's like you never had a heart attack and never needed those bypasses you got." And at the same time, the person who was with me, and we're going to move to Alabama, went to the neurosurgeon, and the neurosurgeon, "I'm going to release you from my care." And when asked why, the neurosurgeon said, "Well, that's because I can find no evidence of the lesions in your brain from the strokes." So the two of us feel that the best way to call it is miraculous healings. And then we left, and then strange stuff followed. Craft, orbs, all sorts of stuff happened.
Let's stick with that. People are going to shout at me if I don't follow up on. So crafts, orbs, let's dig into that. What sort of craft for a start were you seeing?
They were like lit craft. And at first, they were blinking. So at first, I thought it was an aircraft that was flying over the trees. And after staring at it for a minute, I went, "Whoa, that's not an aircraft because it's underneath the trees." And it came to the edge of the yard just outside my fence. In my neighbor's part, and it just sat there and blinked, and I just looked at it for a while and finally grew tired of looking at it and went inside. And then in my front yard where I had a security camera, because I put out security cameras for the following reason. I found cameras hidden on my property aimed at my house that I did not put there. So I assumed that I was under some sort of surveillance. So I put cameras up, and in the front yard, there was a triangle of orbs that did this, maintain a triangular formation, kind of going up and down. And at first I thought they were bugs, and that what I was seeing was the IR light reflecting off the bugs. So I went outside and went around the corner. Just as I rounded the corner, I could see them with my eyes, of course, which are not sensitive to infrared, and they took off and went straight up. So stuff like that. And then I had an entity walk through my room, stop at the end of my bed, look at me. And just as we looked at each other, it vanished. And so the strange stuff like that. And then a person contacted me and said, "Your mother is ill and passing. And I'm sorry to say that, but if you want, I'll give you a reading after she passes." So I went to visit my mother, and she was put on hospice. She began to go downhill rapidly. Whilst on hospice, she was speaking to dead relatives she saw in the room. So, of course, that piqued my curiosity. After the funeral and all that stuff, I contacted the person and I got a reading. That was Lala Bright, who is now my girlfriend and I live with. And she gave me a reading that was unbelievable. There was no doubt at the end of that, Andy. No doubt whatsoever. And I was able to check in multiple ways. That she did not know me or my mother, that my mother had, of course, never written any of this stuff down. And I was told things through her that it is not possible anyone knew but my mother. And so my life just totally changed.
I believe one of those things you were told, because this is something I was curious of, was a nickname you used to mispronounce Sweetie?
Yeah, let me leave that out, because it was like the pièce de résistance. It was just unbelievable. So at the end of the reading, she says, you know, there's a little woman coming through, and she's about 5'2". She gave me a general description, but I was quiet. I wanted to see what would happen. I thought I might know, but I was not going to say. So she says, she keeps saying a word, but her accent is so thick that I can't understand it. My grandmother had a very thick Southern accent. So she says, she keeps saying this word and I don't understand it. And maybe I'm getting it wrong. I says, well, what is it? She said, she keeps saying Tweety, Tweety, like she's emphasizing it over and over and wants me to hear it. And that's when I just, wow, Andy. So when I was one, and after we moved to Alabama, my grandmother would keep me, trying to get to know me. And she called me Sweetie. I couldn't say Sweetie, so I called her Tweety. I'm the oldest grandkid, so that was every grandkid's name for my grandmother was Tweety. And I just knew this reading was real.
Well, listen, Bob, that's a lot to unpack, okay? So I've made some notes to try and go back. So apologies, folks, if I miss anything. I want to start with the fact that you've got an incredibly rich scientific background from that young age, bit of a child prodigy. You're building radios at a young age, amateur radios. You're building telescopes at a young age. You then, through your career, carry on that evolution with your scientific capabilities, your engineering capabilities. Yet, in recent years especially, and then you're talking about the instance with your mother, near-death experiences, there's quite a spiritual connection. Some would call it the woo side of the phenomenon. And I just wonder, that science versus spiritual side of things, where do you fall down on this phenomenon? Can you kind of walk that tightrope in the middle of the nuts and bolts and the orbs and near-death experiences quite easily, or are you torn?
So right now I'm involved in multiple research projects. So for example, recently the middle of the United States up through the Northeast had an eclipse. And I did a radio science experiment during the eclipse where I built a radar which would send pulses up to the ionosphere and the reflections would come back. So we could map the depth and intensity of the ionization inside the ionosphere as we went into eclipse. And so I'm continuing to do science and engineering. I'm working on multiple things for experiential learning for the engineering students at the university where I'm working, which is the University of Scranton, by the way. And so that continues, but I am deeply into this material. I'm putting out cameras and other instruments where I'm taking measurements of the stuff that's happening around us. And so that initially began when Lala and I moved into the house where we now live in Maryland. We began to have strange activities happen in the house. So I made a point to get some security cameras, and I put up a security camera pointing toward the foyer in the front of the house. And one night in the middle of the night, we were asleep. The camera was in night mode, so it was black and white. All of a sudden, you hear some rustling, and you hear click. The light comes on and it goes from night mode to color mode. And at exactly that moment, the deceased father of Lala's child is clearly heard in what paranormal people would call a class A EVP, meaning it was fully voiced. It was a person's voice, not a whisper, not a guttural. It was his voice saying, "Hello, Xander." And that's the name of their son. And it was clear that he was present. And I'm telling you, it kind of wowed me. So I said, well, you know, there's a lot of stuff going over here. Maybe we can gather evidence. And we just started instrumenting the place. And we've nonstop gotten things inside and out since then.
So the idea of hitchhikers, that poltergeist activity, do you think these are all just different labels for a very similar phenomenon? And I include ghosts within that as well. Would you say this is all just the one thing?
So now the theoretical scientific work that I am undertaking is try to find the physical underpinnings of the connection between consciousness and physics. Now, let me explain to you just a bit about what that means. If I could understand the thermodynamics of information and consciousness and how to connect that to the thermodynamics of the rest of physics, that would yield equations that tell you how they're married and give you ways to propose to do experiments that would confirm my theory. So, it's slow but steady because other people have tried and failed, and I'm hoping I get a download, Andy.
Well, listen, explain that download to me. Now, I hear others, including Grant Cameron's been on the podcast a few times. He talks very often of downloads. I get the idea of receiving information, but what is that moment like? Because I think for some, and I like to try and be very fair, if you've not experienced that, it's a very difficult thing, I suppose, to comprehend, because how I receive information is someone speaking to me reading it, listening to podcasts, whatever. Is it literally like the spark of an idea? Is it a feeling that comes with it? Is it an experience? If you could talk me through that.
Okay, so there's no visual experience with it. It can be totally disconnected from what I'm doing, but all of a sudden my train of thought or my stream of consciousness is interfered with, and I have this idea in my head that is an interesting technical problem for me to work on. And so, and after that, I'm obsessed with it. I can't help the obsession. And it's clear something's given me a hint. And it can be visual pictures, but it's not a hallucination like standing out in front. It's not virtual reality out in front of me. Or it's like I will think of an equation or one of those kinds of things. And it's just a sudden, and it's just amazing, this feeling, this overwhelming feeling of correctness, and that I am connected to some major source of information that is showing me something. I am absolutely convinced of the correctness. But most of the time, Andy, I don't understand all of the details of how to write it down in a scientific way. For both Hawkeye and Federated Wireless, when I had these ideas, it took me over a year of working with others to encapsulate those things inside of patents. And you'll see how I do it. I get a team together, and all of our names are on the patents that I got from both Federated Wireless and Hawkeye 360, because I couldn't have finished it without them. I just had the idea with no idea where it came from.
And I wonder, when you get those types of downloads, as a man of science, is there a way you think you could possibly either track the source of that signal, if you want to call it that? Is there a way of recording, a way of measuring that sort of incident? Is that something that interests you, or you think could be done?
It interests me deeply. So I'm going to give you an example of what I've thought about. So recently, Chris Bledsoe was on Beyond Skinwalker Ranch, and they put a brainwave measurement device on his head while he was anticipating one of these orbs flying over. And they saw a measurable thing happen in his brain, recording a state that almost no neurologist or neurosurgeon has ever seen. Okay, so which is this weird state that's not asleep but not awake. So part of his brain that's normally active when you're thinking was nearly shut down, and intuitive part of his brain was very active, and he would interact with it, and they've measured this. So I would love to see, because I get these kind of downloads, strong ones or weak ones, pretty regularly. And so I'd love to see what happens to my brain when that happens. And I just don't know how it happens. But I am attempting to go through both the Monroe process and Sean McDonald process and others to learn to do lucid dreaming, out-of-body experiences, and other things to try to raise my consciousness in a way that I can interact maybe more directly with whatever this is.
Have you got a theory you've built yet on where this is coming from, or even why?
I believe, given these experiences and all of the reading I've done, that consciousness is non-local. That means it's not wholly in my body. That there's something this transmitter receiver up here is connecting to that runs the rest of this avatar. And so that's my theory, but I haven't got it put together in a way that I could describe it scientifically. So I just want to make measurements of it. but I've seen my girlfriend Lala Bright do things with her mind where she remote views, talks to people she's never met, and she'll get these real unbelievable mental interruptions, and she will go and look up who the people are, contact them and say, I have a message for you from so-and-so. And to watch those interactions happen, it's amazing. So this to me tells me this is non-local and there's some kind of communications connection. So I'm an information theorist engineer. I understand Claude Shannon's information theorems. And so I'm looking for the channel and the coding for how that goes. And I don't know the answer, but I'm going to work at it until I can anymore.
I'm with you on the idea of the brain being the receiver. It's the radio. The signal's coming from somewhere else. We're not making the music. That's just being beamed in. Whatever this consciousness experience is, and the body just kind of lives out the physical side of it. That makes a lot of sense, but I don't have the brains, the intellect, the time, the wherewithal to study that. That's down to people like you to try and figure out. And I wonder, you mentioned, and this is tied in, Chris Bledsoe, one of, if not the most famous experiencer on the planet. Now, his story is fascinating. I've hosted Chris, I've hosted Ryan. His story can be divisive as well because it's such a spiritual aspect of the phenomenon, the woo aspect of the phenomenon, because there's much less nuts and bolts to Chris Bledsoe's story than there is a lot of faith, religion, orb sightings, experiences. You know, I wonder for you, what makes the Bledsoe story so authentic?
Okay, so both my personal experiences and the fact that I knew of and know about serious people inside the U.S. government that, let's say, learned of an experiment that I proposed to Chris that he and I do. And then after that, because COVID came, I never could go back. And either he told them or they overheard it. And the experiment was how to demonstrate his non-local connection to the phenomenon in a way that would convince them. And the experiment went as follows. It was what I proposed, and people in the government and Chris accomplished it. They were somewhere in the United States, and they put up a collection of sensors. And these collection of sensors were involved cameras and other things. And his job was to communicate with his local entities and ask them if they would show up in front of and be detected by the cameras and sensors. And it happened instantaneously right on cue. And then that went further when John Alexander and a bunch of other people went with Chris and his daughter, Emily, and she is as strong as he is, went to the Monroe Institute with a bunch of other people to investigate this phenomenon. And there were skeptics there, and the skeptics left non-skeptical because a thing appeared in the sky and hung there for a long time while everybody who attended this knew about it. And subsequent to that was when Beyond Skinwalker Ranch recorded his brain waves interacting with whatever this is. So there's been sufficient evidence now gathered outside of my own two eyes and ears and other things that I've seen by serious people using serious equipment that I could go buy if I wanted to spend that much money and do it myself. He has something going on that is measurable and repeatable.
So with so many, and that's a big intriguing aspect of the Bledsoe story, there are so many intelligence officials that we hear of or have heard could have been interested. You see the pictures from weddings and family get-togethers that are filled with the IC community in the backgrounds at dances and whatnot. There's something to that story, just purely from that point of view alone. I think, personally, there are elements of it. I think sometimes some of the videos Chris posts aren't orbs. I don't think a light in the sky is showing me much. And I've always been honest, Bob, and if you've heard me, some of the orb stuff I struggle with because they can be misidentified bugs, you know, whatnot. But there are some other very genuinely interesting cases of orbs captured or spoken of, and I'm more than happy to go in with that. I wonder, with that strong intelligence interest in the Bledsoe family, the Bledsoe experience, why do you think there's such a pushback still from other aspects of the intelligence community and government, who surely must be hearing of, you know, those incidents and what's happening?
Right now, we're seeing major pushback from inside the government on anything that would lead to full UFO disclosure to the public. So I think that some of those same entities who are now opposing UAP disclosure flowing through Congress and the White House are now are also involved in providing disinformation and other things about Chris Bledsoe. And so just truth in advertising, I've done a lot of interesting work for my country over three decades. And while I did not know about this and no communication happened between us, the reason I was invited by Chris to visit is Jim Semivan told him to let me in, that it would almost surely be interesting. And I learned that after I arrived at Chris's. So, you know, I have a reputation, and I've been awarded medals and other things inside the intelligence community. And this person would have known that. And that let me know that others inside government knew who I was and that I was going. And I'm sure after that, especially given the cameras that were around my new home in Alabama, that I was being observed in some ways.
You mentioned that work in the intelligence community, medals you've received for the, you know, the validation of your work with them. You've had top secret clearances in the past. Not that that's been UFO related necessarily. You've not been in crash retrieval programs, as far as I know. And if you have been, Bob, great time to talk about it now. But I wonder, from your point of view, how has that working with top secret clearances helped you research and investigate the UFO phenomenon, maybe in a way someone like myself getting involved can't or wouldn't understand?
Yeah, so when the phenomenology of what I'm seeing coming out of government being handled outside by people who aren't familiar with how things work inside aids me to help them understand how all this could come about. And so it's really hard for people to understand how a big external report is put together inside the U.S. government. So kind of the first thing I've really dug in on was one of the early reports out of UAPTF. And when that happens, if it's going to the public, it is passed all over the United States government to any entity that has brushed up against the content for them to comment on and make corrections to. And so that's just the way stuff is done. They reach consensus of all interested parties inside before something comes to the outside, except in the Arrow report. The recent Arrow report, DNI refused to approve it because they were not given approval on it. So just this kind of experience on how things work on the inside. For example, the Kona Blue proposal, which blew up in the news, I knew instantly what a huge revelation that was and why Kirkpatrick was told to make little of it, because that didn't happen by chance. You don't do those kinds of things without a reason. And that it went all the way up and got a security clearance and other things was a huge deal. And it was about two things: crash retrievals and reverse engineering being proposed to come under the umbrella of DHS. That does not go to the hot top of DHS and get a security clearance without the top of DIA allowing Lokatsky and others to take it out of DIA and take it to DHS. They had permission to do that. So you understanding how government works and the kind of things they would have to go through, approvals to transmit information to convince the new government entity to take it on. And they came that close until they got major pushback.
Has how Arrow has gone about their work surprised you in any way, shape or form? I think for many from the get-go, it was going to be a whitewash, a downplaying of the UFO subject. And that's what it's turned out to be. Was that something you expected?
I was very hopeful. Especially since Senator Gillibrand and the Deputy Secretary of Defense were involved, and I believed in them. But what I think is they chose an official who was already co-opted to run it. And the co-opting of Kirkpatrick was done long before he went there. And he worked in places where, for example, Admiral Bobby Inman was on the board of directors of the place he worked for. And he has, Kirkpatrick is very capable. He has serious capabilities and achievements inside of government on behalf of the United States. A lot of it in Space Command and elsewhere. This guy is very capable. And it is not a serious thing to write a report that's supposed to cover history without covering history. And the third reference be to a wiki fandom page. I mean, this was an insult. It was an insult fired at all of those who wanted that report to come out. It was worse than the UAPTF stuff from the beginning.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. And I think what's come out the back of it is many of us are hoping some of these 40 rumored whistleblowers are going to come forward and be another David Grush. David Grush done fantastically well to sit there and create a bit of a shockwave. And it did go around the world. And I can say that I've mentioned many times, Bob, that in the UK, the subject isn't taken as seriously by the mainstream, by politicians. It's not touched upon in the slightest. That did cause a bit of a wave that many serious publications and news broadcasters talked about it just for a very short time. And I wonder if a raft of David Grushies can come forward one after another, that could be a real positive. I want to start, though, maybe with the negative. And this is on recent Jason Sands. This is the first time I'm talking about it since it happened. I was ill in the last week, so I've not managed to record. Now, he is a whistleblower who has come forward. He was rumoured to be in James Fox's upcoming documentary, his follow-up to The Phenomenon. Jason Sands came out early and appeared on a Twitter space that was over 5 hours long. I've seen you comment on it as well, which is good. Keep me right here, Bob. It looks like he said some things that weren't necessarily lying, but it seems were inaccurate, or he had to walk back very slightly afterwards, just misspeaking. And maybe that's the trap of going into a 5 hour plus Twitter space that isn't regulated, that you're unprepared for, that isn't a formal interview and is going to be picked over by everyone else. It seems since Jason Sands is who he says he is, he isn't lying about what his job was, but there seems to be a lot of inaccuracies that have come out of it, a lot of potentially misinformation, but that's the nature of social media. Let's talk about, if you don't mind summing up for me, this Jason Sands situation as you see it.
Okay, so he came out, said he had experiences. I have no information about what he did at Nellis Air Force Base outside of what he said he did. And it sounded like a fairly rudimentary task for an Air Force person. So it sounds like he's non-commissioned. And he was escorting something through the desert and ran into this blue alien, as he claims, that was standing there in the desert and mistook him for someone that the blue alien was expecting to meet, and then talked to him about being in telepathic observation of the people that were still back in the vehicle. And so I have no information about that. It's an interesting story, and that's all I can say. But his mentioning the blue alien immediately led to a tidal wave of angry questions. You could see where it was going. They were trying to trap him in to the Corey Good Gaia crap about the blue avians. And then someone mentioned, well, tell us about 20 and back. And he says afterwards, he mistook that to mean other things than what they were meaning. And so he stepped on two landmines in ufology. This 20 years on Serpo and then coming back, or leaving for 20-year commission tour on the secret space program and then being brought back in time right to where you started after 20 years. So he stepped on these landmines that people really discount. He walked them back and they tried to explain. And since then, he's gotten much more careful. So after, and the reason for him coming out is I think it was in self-defense. I believe that he and others are watching how David Grush acted, and they are emulating it. So he, when James Fox was caught on a still camera shot, snapshot, still frame from a video with Jason Sands on the clapboard while he was being interviewed, that let Jason Sands' name out of the bag. And so you know how people are in ufology. They look at every nut and bolt and every book on a shelf and everything else, and they saw it and it went wild. So Grush has been very valuable to people that want to come out. He showed them how to bulletproof their coming out. First of all, they get Doppler approval. The defense, Department of Defense, for example, approves the things you can say in public. And so long as he sticks to that religiously, like he was going to go to, you know, Blue Blazes if he didn't stick to it, he sticks to it. But he understood how the process works inside. Inside, those who would be opposed have to identify themselves in writing, have to name the program that they are fighting to protect, to keep it from coming out. So they would get these things that cannot be approved to come out or allowed not to be spoken of, and use those to stop him from saying anything about some program. But the other things he wanted to tell, he's allowed to say openly. And so Grush showed people how to work the process in their favor. And he got a lawyer, a good one. The former Inspector General of the Intelligence Community was able to help him maneuver through the minutiae of getting Doppler approval and not misspeaking in a way that would get him into trouble for violating his security oaths. So I think others are now seeing how their situations can be a parallel to what David Grush has done. And I believe, now that I'm hearing it everywhere, that others are going to come out and it'll be great. I do believe we're going to get to enough of them eventually, maybe not until after the election, where the dam will break.
Do you think in that respect, because you've said it, that David Grush showed the way, Jason Sands, unfortunately, has been the first one to follow and doesn't seem to have followed David's footsteps directly? He's like, I think you've put it well, he stepped on a few ufology landmines, which is a hell of a landscape to navigate for anyone coming into this. Even just from a research point of view, or, you know, trying to find a podcast to or a documentary to watch or a way to get into the subject can be so difficult. This guy's came in as a whistleblower and it just seems he's gone about it the wrong way. So maybe we've now got two very good examples of what to do and also what not to do in terms of being a whistleblower, trying to come out and share your story in the UFO topic. I wonder if David Grush hadn't been as well advised and had followed a different path, and he himself first came out in a Twitter space and maybe talked about some of those things that were more opinion than revelation, it may have gone the same way for David Grush. Do you think that's fair?
I think it's reasonably fair. David Grush was a very high-ranking intelligence officer, so he understood completely about the Inspector General process. And when he began being administratively bludgeoned, he knew immediately that he had an Inspector General case. And he got the right lawyer and went to multiple intelligence community, multiple inspector generals, DOD, NIC, and he knew the process. He knew how to follow it. And he had it inside. He was internalized already. Sands just has not ever been that very, very high-level intelligence officer. So, And he's been, in the early days, he was a bit of a loner. He came out and talked to people that I know. I knew about Sands long before his name was known. And he talked to people that I know. And they were very excited about who he was. But, of course, they didn't have access to any way to check on him. And so it's just a bit of a bother the way he's come out. So I think he's hurt the impact of his story when he didn't need to. Can it recover? I believe so, if other things are allowed to come out. But let me say the following. I want to make it very, very clear I have been told by people that are inside that I know and trust, really, really trust, that Sands is the real deal. Now, the downside of this is I don't have a piece of paper. I don't have anything other than my own personal testimony that my information came from people that I trust.
On the flip side of that, I think one of the other bigger or biggest stories of recent times, I'm going to ask your opinion on it, is of the Nazca mummies presented by Jaime Massan and his colleagues. This is one that certainly I've had to run my eye back over a few times now, and I'm still on a certain side of the fence, but it's been a very emotive subject for many, Bob. It's the most emotive. I put out one in the breakdown episodes, and the YouTube comments were wildly split as to this should be given more attention, more validity, be taken seriously. And on the other side, it's a nonsense, it's damaging, this is ridiculous, it's another hoax. It's very muddied in terms of what's going on here, but the story's not going away. We now have some American scientists and academics involved in it, and they're still pushing forward. And I wonder, what's your take on these potential or alleged non-human entities?
The disaster of how it came out is very non-traditional in scientific circles. You don't come announce new scientific things through a Jaime Massan type TV person. You do work, you do research in labs, you get together your data, you write a paper, you can put the paper in a public place and then get peer review by your peers, looking at the work you've done, where they get access to the data and they can confirm what you've done. So none of it followed the standard science procedure. And so many wouldn't go and be involved because Jaime Massan was involved. So, but it appears now that some scientists of some reputation are now involved. And I am sitting on the fence, looking at both sides, waiting till the scientists announce what they have to announce. And they tell you right now, they've got to be independent of Jaime Massan, free from commercial or other pressure to say what they do and tell what they have to tell. And if it's utterly independent, holds up under peer review, then I'll be convinced that these are something real. Because what we're hearing is there's non-human DNA in these things.
I think that's what interests me, is the fact that the Americans now involved, and this has nothing to do with the fact wahoo, the Americans are here, okay, to save the day, but they've come in and at least sounded very sensible to say there may be something interesting here, but the work will take time and we have to allow that time to be taken for the science to be done. Like you say, I think Jaime and co seem to have come out very quick to shout from the rafters, we have essentially alien bodies here, which is what they're saying. Whereas we've got some folks coming in to say there may be something interesting, but let's just hold fire. And I think that's what got a lot of people's backs up, that people like myself were not all in on this. And I'm just with you, Bob, in that the optics of how this was presented from the get-go didn't sit well with me. I can be wrong on that. That is just my opinion. That's fine. People don't have to like it. I just wish it had been handled a far, probably not unsimilarly to Jason Sands' story. If it had been handled differently, you could end up with a David Grush situation or a Jason Sands situation where you're having to walk back and start again from square one before you'd even left square one. So, you know, that for me is the way this has kind of been presented. Do you think there's something to it then, or is it too early to tell?
Too early for me to tell, but I tell you, it's rescued itself with me from being flushed down the toilet to whether I'm ready to take a look at it. But I want these scientists outside of any pressure to be able to do real science before I'm willing to give it a lot of credence.
Bob, before we get to some listener questions to start rounding off, I want to ask you, how do you see the role of science and scientists in the researching of UFOs changing in the coming years? You're someone who's seen decades of engineering and science. For me, I've seen this change quickly in the last couple of years with more academics coming in, the Saul Foundation's presentation, bringing on a whole new wraith of people, which has been fantastic. What are your thoughts on how science can really, you know, get its teeth into the UFO topic going forward?
So Saul Foundation and other entities could have a big impact on all of this. I think Galileo has gotten off to something of a rough start, but is continuing to do good work. And there are citizen scientist organizations that are telling people how to assemble sensor systems that are reasonable cost. So I'm going to give you a different context that's applicable. Astronomy is a really, really interesting thing. There's tons of data available anytime there's a clear sky or you can see the sun or the moon. The issue is there's not enough scientists and instruments to record anywhere near all of it. But for over 100 years, there have been these citizen scientist organizations. One in particular is the American Association of Variable Star Observers, homed in Massachusetts in Cambridge, that has organized the activities of citizen observers to gather data that will help the scientists do their work, because a scientist gets time on a big telescope a few minutes out of a year, whereas a citizen scientist can enhance that considerably by doing observations every night it's clear. Let me give you one specific example. We put TESS into outer space. TESS maps the cosmos all over the place with very wide, deep cameras, and it's looking for things coming in between a star and us. And the hypothesis, when we see that happen, is it could be an exoplanet. Okay, so you've gotten this time, you've seen it. And then after that, we don't know anything about the orbit of the planet around the star, so it has to be observed nearly continuously to figure out if it is actually an exoplanet, and if so, what orbit it is in. And so amateur observers, including me, are taking a look at stars through their telescopes to find these dips in the light curve. And once you have enough of that data, you can tell a lot about the planet, its size, its orbital period, all sorts of stuff. It's the light coming from the sun through the atmosphere will dark lines in it, and these dark lines tell you the chemical composition of the atmosphere. So this is how amateurs can help professionals. The same kind of thing is going to happen to me with UAPs. There's a lot of scientific instruments that amateurs can put together and use, and that will help all the people who want to do serious science, so long as the amateurs follow the necessary rules to really help us figure out stuff. Because what we really, really need is usable, repeatable data that the scientists can trust where it came from and that it hasn't been tampered with.
Let's get to some of these listener questions, Bob, before my voice gives up on me. Hopefully people listening won't have heard any coughs. Some of the folks watching might have seen me have to mute, so apologies, folks. Lots of interest. And as we speak, Bob, I'm still getting listener questions coming in, so I might dip into my emails in just a second to grab those ones out. But first off, Dave Smethurst asks a few questions of you.
Hi, Dave. Glad you're here.
Oh, I know Dave asked a few questions on the Good Trouble show, Matt Ford, when you were on there as well. Dave gets about. So hello to Dave. Dave says that many world religions saw reality as a product as of the mind of God, and we can all have fragments of that mind within us. One form of this was Gnosticism. To what extent does Bob think quantum physics and the double slit experiment has contributed to our new thinking on the role of consciousness? And how does it resemble these old ideas in essence?
So if you are able to observe multiple small quantum objects being fired one at a time through double slits, you don't observe it, you will get an interference pattern on the screen. So, but if you do anything at all to observe it, the interference pattern collapse and becomes two lines like you were firing bullets through the two slits. So this has led people to think that conscious observation of a quantum entity collapses the wave function so that consciousness is intimately involved. We're not quite ready to say that's true. Now, a lot of scientists, they hate the idea, so they poo-poo it, and their arguments are not valid. So, in other words, this is something that still needs experimenting. So I knew John Wheeler before he died, and John Wheeler projected that gave us an extremely interesting experiment besides training Richard Feynman and other Nobel laureates. He was a great physics educator. Okay, so if you fire these objects through the slits and you wait until long after they've passed the slits because they're moving at the speed of light, you'll know after they've gone through. Then you look at them over here, it affects all the way back in time before the objects went through the slits and collapses the wave function. This is called the quantum erasure experiment, and it just lets you know the quantum world is really, truly weird. So I just think we're going to have more data and more science to definitively state that quantum is impacted by consciousness. And I want to encourage people to go look, for example, at the many hundreds of papers where Dean Radin was an author, because he's been doing experiment after experiment after experiment to show that consciousness can impact quantum systems.
Dave follows up with another question. He says, we now seem to know that really all reality is all vibration. Oh, sorry, I'll start that again. We now seem to know that really all matter is vibration. What did Bob think of Bryce Zabel's tale of the naval intelligence guy who said that the secret of the universe was sound, light, and frequency? Has he heard of that? And what did he think it meant and what it may mean for how non-human intelligence technology works?
Can I tell you that I've actually known that? I'm 70 and I've known it since I was 20. Okay, so I'm going to tell you, and that was not a download. Okay. Quantum mechanics mathematically is most easily written down, the wave function, as the sum, a large sum of many different time waveforms. And all of them are like sinusoids, tones. So quantum mechanics has always been the sum of tones. And each of those tones, the energy, is directly related to the frequency. And we know this from de Broglie's work and others who did, Einstein who did E equals H nu, and de Broglie who figured out the wavelength of matter. And then Einstein also told us E equals mc squared. So we know that matter is already energy. We know that energy is quantum, and that quantum is made up of waves, which are different frequencies. This has always been known. And the quantum field theory, which is the current version of our best science at the quantum level, assumes that the universe is populated by quantum oscillators. So the description of the universe is like these quantum oscillators are all over. And from all of those things working together, you build a field of things that govern the electron, another field that governed the proton, et cetera, et cetera. So this has always been actually known. Now, whether or not we can interact with that, modify the frequencies, et cetera, that is a thing that is of interest because it's the nonstop story that people who are into the woo tell. Is that you want to raise your frequency, change your vibration, and if you do, you can interact with these beings. So at least there's some little physics from way back that sounds like it's consistent with this, but I don't know how to engineer that. So it's understanding how to engineer that so that we can see the other things that have different frequencies or in different dimensions, which are the same thing, by the way. Different frequencies and different dimensions. So anyway, how to make that work, I don't know the engineering, and that would be a really great thing to understand.
Thanks for that answer, Bob. And one more from Dave. I'll give him the three. He's listened to you for many years talk about secret disclosure wars between the forces of non-disclosure and those who are pro-disclosure. What do you think the state of play is now? And do you think the genie could go back into the bottle?
The genie cannot go back into the bottle because the United States government has admitted that three videos were real and that spheres are flying all over the world, and then showed it to us in front of Congress in an unclassified public hearing. That the genie's too far out of the bottle to go back in. The thing that's going to try to be done, which will need legislation to undo, is keep it so classified no one can mention it. So they're going to try to keep it classified and forbid people from talking about it. But if the something like the did not pass, but close to passing, UAP Disclosure Act were actually to pass, the president sign it, and then this group get up. And the difference is, if the UAP Disclosure Act would have passed, everything would have been unclassified. That is, you had a short amount of time to bring stuff forward to argue for keeping it classified. And if you didn't, it would be unclassified. That was a sledgehammer that would have broken the dam, and we'd have been covered with a tidal wave. And the inside people got in the way of it. And I think it was the major mistake was appealing to Congress critters to end the part about eminent domain, which is the government can take what it wants if it's of national interest and national good and national security. So I think a new version of the Disclosure Act needs to pass. And once that happens, nothing can go back.
This next question from Algo has a couple of questions within it, but they're all related, so bear with me. In the transdimensional hypothesis, we assume that an object or a phenomenon can move or show itself in at least two different dimensions. Why do we assume that these dimensions are moving in synchronicity through time and space? They can move at different speeds or in different directions. Could that explain how the UAP can apparently move fast in our dimension? Because it's not them moving fast, but it's the other dimension they are rooted in that moves fast relative to ours. For instance, our galaxy moves through space at more than 1,000,000 miles per hour. So that's what you have to cope with if you move through dimensions. What are your thoughts on that, Bob?
So here is kind of the evidence that tweaks my curiosity. You have all of these stories that are coming out and are being leaked or experienced by people who've gone inside of craft, come back and tell stories. And what are these stories? They go through a hatch into the craft, and they think the thing is 25 feet across and 15 feet wide, but they go through the hole and it's big as a football field. That can only happen if the inside of the craft is in other dimensions. It just can't happen any other way. Okay, so unless they're imposing an illusion on your consciousness. Okay, so either it is an illusion imposed on our consciousness, or the inside is up in other dimensions. And who's to say? Who's to say? Since we haven't been in these other dimensions, that the speed of light is the limit in the other dimensions. So let's suppose my hand is our universe, and something wants to visit our universe. So it would be like my finger going through my hand. It would be seen as the cross section of my finger as it goes through, but as I get away through, it goes out. So you would see a little shadow of my finger going through. So if we could poke through and come out here there might be no speed of light. We may be able to travel as fast as we want to and get there in a flick of an eye. So that is, to me, that is absolutely mathematically possible. Is it possible in some physics that we can realize and actualize with actual engineering? I don't know the answer.
That's a fair answer, and thank you for explaining it in a way someone like me understands as well. A question from Christian. He says, have you ever heard of academics that take an interest on this issue and get surveilled or maybe even suffer some form of high-pitched frequency in their ears?
So that has been reported by numerous individuals who are in and out of science and government and people who... it's clear someone did not want them talking. So this has happened. I believe that I've been surveilled by one means or another, including we see helicopters fly over our house at illegal heights all the time. So the answer is yes, but I don't know the extent of it. I don't know who's actually involved in it because I can't see the markings on the helicopters.
No, that's fair. A question from Yes, No, Maybe says, could I ask, is there a way to jackboot a hack RF, and I'm guessing it means radio frequency, to pick up a higher frequency range that one might be close to an NDA territory?
The answer is hack RF is a device. I have one here. I will show you. I have one over here on my desk, but I'm not going to spend time grabbing it now. It is a software-defined receiver, which means it has an antenna, takes the signals coming from the antenna, turns them into numbers, and the numbers are passed over to the computer, and all the radio functions are done in the computer. Okay, so it's a software-defined radio. The hack RF, there are converters, which you can move the frequency it covers down or move the frequency it covers up, and the answer to the question is yes. You've got to find a converter you put in front of the hack RF that, for example, will let it listen to 1.6 gigahertz and up, because everybody and their brother is claiming 1.6 gigahertz has something to do with UFOs. The answer is yes.
And another question, same listener. What does Bob know about one old guard freelance colonel, it's John Alexander, who you've mentioned, and a portal being behind MyLab abductions? Was there something that made Bob and Lala so upset with John a while ago? Bob mentioned people screaming and pointing when AJ walked into a conference that Lala had screen memories associated with him.
So she has had screen memories that she's recalled. She's never met John Alexander in person. I have. I've met him multiple times in person. I mean, people can go on my ex-Twitter account and see a picture as my cover picture of John Alexander, Gary Nolan, Melinda Leslie, and Eric Davis and I standing together at the SCU conference. So I know John, and he and I are friendly, but there are several experiencers that relate the following story. When John first began coming out and attending experiencer conferences or experiencer sessions in conferences, multiple people would stand up and scream and point at him and saying, "You were at my labs." And Lala's memory was every time she saw his face, a mental thing would happen and the word dad would come into her head. Now, this smacks of conditioning done at a deep level. And it had to have, if that's true, it would have been done by someone who was cognizant of her family situation. She was deeply close to her father. He was the most important person in her life growing up. He helped her with her abilities because he was a light worker, Reiki master, experienced UFOs with her. So that would have been the perfect thing to try to condition her into going along and behaving. And she's had definite memories of my labs and definite memories of abductions and hybridization and other things. She's been through it. I mean, like a lot of experiencers. And, you know, there are millions of them. So she's not unique. It's just interesting to know one personally that can talk to you about it.
No, of course. A couple of questions from El Californio. Do you have any suggestions for Lou Elizondo from yourself, Bob, to help his book get freed from the grasps of the National Security Clearinghouse?
No, he just has to continue to argue. He and his lawyer will continue to argue with or make sure that the government follows every rule, crosses every T, dots every I, for whatever exemption and exception they want to impose on him for release, because they are required by statute to give him an explanation and where the objection comes from. And these people do not want to talk about the programs they are in. It's what Grush figured out. That's the magic that Grush figured out. I mean, I couldn't believe he was sitting in front of Congress talking about crash retrievals that had bodies in them. And then I figured out why. He had done the Doppler approval, and they would have had to identify the crash retrieval reverse engineering program they were in order to register an objection. And they wouldn't do it.
Using the system against them, essentially, aren't they? Using their own system.
He engineered the system against them.
Same listener actually asks, when do you expect, or do you still expect, we will see a David Grush op-ed?
I believe that he is holding on until the House of Representatives figures out through its current speaker if they're going to stand up this special committee. Because my understanding is the plan is for him to be hired as a cleared staffer for this committee. If so, that would be optimal. So I think that's in limbo while he tries to figure out what his future is. Because I guarantee you there's not much of a future in the United States right now selling real estate.
No, I think David Grush's timing is going to be important for this one, isn't it? And again, same listener, will we have a serious attempt at disclosure or partial disclosure by the presidential election?
I don't think so. Maybe, but look, politicians do not want to do crazy stuff for which they cannot predict the outcome in an election year.
And I agree with you, Bob. I don't think it'll be an election campaign issue, but I wonder, do you think or can you see the question of UFOs or UAP being brought up in any debates?
You know, I could, but I don't know what the outcome would be. Now, I don't know how much coordination goes on with these questions and the interviewers. I just don't know the answer. Biden and Trump are likely to both scoff at it.
Yeah,
if it's brought up, because they're in defense mode when they're on these debates. They are got their iron curtain up to keep themselves from making a screw up.
Yeah, I agree with that. A question from Here's Johnny. He says, seeing how Bob is so prolific on the phenomenon, and also him and his wife are both girlfriend, Lala's girlfriend, are both experiencers. Is there any evidence he could bring to the table he feels would move the needle forward?
So I have, like most other experiences, I have a stack full of videos and photos and other things, and they are available on Lala Bright and my Facebook page inside of a photo video album. And the album is called Pictures from Our Cameras. And anybody can go look at it because it's publicly available. And there's some interesting stuff in there. Some of it's extremely convincing. Some of it looks like the mushy lights you see from others. Some of it's videos in which weird things happen. And we just do the best we can. And we don't hold anything back. Anything that to me looks anomalous, we put it in there. And it happens often.
Well, Bob, let me just finish up by asking you one more question. 2024, big year. We've got the election in the United States, which is going to decide a lot of things for not only the states, but the world, because that's the impact the US has on the rest of the planet. What do you see as the future this year and beyond for the UFO topic?
I think it's way behind the eight ball with elections and war. The United States is basically hot or cold war on multiple fronts. Now, the U.S. under Biden pulled off a miracle fomented by Putin. He put every country in Europe that actually had the ability into NATO, including Finland and Switzerland. I mean, Sweden. I just couldn't believe it. And I still am like dumbfounded that all of that was pulled off. And I tell you what I think it is. I think, especially now that they're coming out with the secrets that what Putin's actual objectives were and what he is saying about operationalizing nuclear weapons, I think the Biden administration scared the crap out of the Europeans and others, and then how China is working with Russia, working against Russia while working with them. And now he has all these Asian down through Australian countries interacting with us through AUKUSA and going to add themselves to it. The United States has its plate full, but we are maintaining politically the agreement that we signed just before the end of World War II with all the countries we could get together at Bretton Woods in New Hampshire in 1944 and then maintained and modified after the World War, where we set up the international commerce systems, international banking systems, and the security systems that the United States currently maintains. And I believe that all of the cost for all of that has been repaid to us by factors of 10, several factors of 10. The worldwide economic boom and rise of standard of living and gross domestic product going all through the roof over the world was enabled by the United States saying to the world, we will build a navy that will go all the seven seas, and we will not allow piracy to get you anywhere, and you will have open access to our markets. We won't put up barriers and tariffs. And we didn't until Trump became president. So that set the stage for where we are. I hope that does not change. Now, what it means is a mistake in Europe and the world is at war. One mistake and the world can be at war. One missile go over to Belarus or Russia, or one thing gets shot down over a NATO country, and Article 5 is invoked, and we're at war. It's a tough year to see a lot of stuff go on for UAP, and along with the election. It's just a tough year, Andy.
Had to get a quick cough in there, Bob. And do you think, again, that worst-case scenario, this is something I spoke with Danny Sheehan about last week, do you think another world war would invoke or provoke any non-human intelligences on the planet into an appearance, an intervention, or do you think that's potentially some blue sky thinking from folks?
Over your left shoulder behind you is a book called UFO of God. It is the story of Christopher Bledsoe's experiences. And in it, he talks about the time he was first abducted and was flown to the Middle East and shown an astronomical event over the pyramids looking northeast, and it's where he saw a nuclear war break out and NHI intervene. So I don't know, but there's so many people involved in this topic that tell that same story in one way or another. And it feels to me like we're approaching something major geopolitically and with the UAP. I just don't know what it is. I wish I did.
Well, Bob, thank you very much for your time. I'd love to get you back on sooner than later. Hopefully one time when I've not got this cough to contend with as well. Wonderful speaking with you. I could have went double that as well. I look forward to the next time, Bob. And all of Bob's social links will be in the description to this podcast as well. Thanks again for your time, Bob. That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify. Just search That UFO Podcast Premium. YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It wasn't a Tic Tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer, a little Baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the